Hey everybody, you're listening to Top Quartile, where we bring you stories from the front lines of growth in community-focused financial services. Well, hello and welcome. I'm Dan Marks, a partner and EVP here, and my special guest today is Sam Kilmer. Sam and I go way back in the industry, and he's had some interesting jobs, which he'll tell you about in a minute. But right now, he is an advisor, speaker, partner, and writer at Cornerstone Advisors, and is the co-host of another podcast, The FinTech Hustle. So Sam, thanks for being on the show. How are you today?
I'm great, Dan. It's good to be talking with you again. I feel like, you know, it's just like when we were in the hallways of some conference many years ago when we've been in the industry so long. It's like old times, as they say.
That's right. Well, so you have had kind of a long journey, and tell us about your background, what you're doing now at Cornerstone.
Yeah. So what I'm doing now at Cornerstone is I lead our fintech advisory practice, which includes, you know, advising fintech firms ranging from the, you know, kind of the largest mature industry players all the way down to startup, you know, fintechs, whether they're challengers or software firms or whatever. And, you know, I've been at Cornerstone now for going on 9 years. And I started out here in strategic planning with banks and credit unions. And my background prior to being here at Cornerstone was I was a bank exec. I started out in marketing and analytics as a banker, mid-sized bank. And then I was also a digital banking leader when that was a new thing. You know, now digital banking is the primary channel, but when it was called the alternative channel, right? If you remember that.
Oh, yes. Alternative channels. That's right.
Hey, you know a lot about computers. Why don't you run our digital banking division? So that was a fun ride through the banking world. And then I spent about 15 years in the bank tech space working for a couple of the origination system, analytics system, core system providers. I started out in training and implementations and worked my way into consulting. And then ultimately I ended up in like the partnership area and then ultimately mergers and acquisitions. Cause you know, you start connecting systems together and you start seeing how things tie together. So that's a little bit about me and my crusty old boring banker story, huh?
Hey, everybody on the show is a banker or FI or FinTech related some way. We all sort of navigate like rivers flowing through it. So what's one fascinating fact about you, Sam, that most people don't know?
So I guess one thing about me is, and you can kind of see a little bit about it here, no corporate backgrounds here. I'm a musician. You could call me a hack musician. I was a trained drummer, but ultimately end up getting into playing a little bit of guitar and have collected old and new records since, well, it's a bad habit and it's lasted a long time, but it's a good left brain, right brain thing for the banking and fintech world. So that's a little bit about me. Hack musician.
And you got the guitar on the background on the wall to prove it. So, what's kind of the origin of the Gonzo Banker?
Yeah, I'd love to take credit for that. I won't. The founders of our consulting firm, Cornerstone Advisors, even before, I believe it predates the founding of the firm 20 some years ago, they actually had the Gonzo Banker. At the time, it was a newsletter, ultimately an e-newsletter, and then it was a blog, and it's sort of made the transition over the years. And what I think is really neat about it is it really, before even people talked in terms of content marketing or anything like that, it was really just some entrepreneurs that were starting up a consulting firm and said, wouldn't it be great if we could just write something fearless that nobody else seems to be writing about, keep it fun. And oh, by the way, we don't have any money for marketing anyway, and nobody knows who we are. So why don't we just put some stuff out there that we think would be really, really cool? And they were, I guess, one of the things, and it actually, I will have to say, Gonzo Banker drew me to the firm more than the Cornerstone brand, predominantly just because I saw something they had written about the space. And I think it was my company even, I don't think it was in Haiku even. Just very creative, very off the cuff, flip, fun, but not mean-spirited. And the other thing was, it was smart. It was embedded into the, so the Gonzo journalism from Hunter S. Thompson as an inspiration comes from the idea of, you know, not simply just going out and doing formal corporate reporting, but embedding yourself, you know, into the space. So we write about what we know. We're in and out of several hundred banks and credit unions in the United States every year. It's what we know, and without, you know, giving away any kind of confidential information or anything, we write about what we know in the trenches. And so that's where it came from. And it's been a treat to be a, a contributor to that over the years.
Yeah, it's funny. I think we all probably associate Gonzo Banker with Cornerstone intimately, and maybe, you know, truth be, from a branding perspective, we all think of Gonzo first. I can't tell you how many people I've mentioned Cornerstone to over the years, and then they go, Cornerstone, that sounds familiar. Oh, those are the guys that put out the Gonzo Banker email. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, to your point, standing out and taking a point of view, and that's a neat story about Gonzo journalism tie-in. You mentioned you guys are in and out of banks, and of course fintech, and fintech could mean probably everybody who uses the word, it means that's slightly different, although there's some commonly accepted sort of categories. But from what you see, what are some interesting trends that you're seeing lately?
Well, yeah, and I should point out that we work with several hundred banks and credit unions a year. And one of the things that, you know, what we've called the mid-size market that we focus on, you know, one of the things that's really consistent across the mid-size market is banks and credit unions in the mid-size market might build some things internally. You know, they might build a small business application or whatever. But for the most part, they are buyers or cobblers of technology and solutions from the ecosystem. And so when you're in and out of several hundred banks and credit unions a year, you kind of see some things that work and don't work in the execution of technology, but also the execution of services like payments and lending. And anyway, so those experiences, I guess you would say, just kind of give us a lot of ground level looks into what works in terms of fintech coming into banks and credit unions. But at the same time, one of the key trends we're seeing is banks are becoming fintechs. Fintechs are becoming banks, either by way of acquisitions or partnerships. It's one key trend is it's just a messy sandbox of people playing together. Fun. It's a fun messy. But that would be one trend, is just a lot of things that are coming together. I think another thing, I'm providing advisory services to fintech firms. And what I find interesting is I think we've historically thought of banks as being very, very different. They're a separate vertical, that they have their own regulations. True. They have their own phenomena. It's all true. But there are some things that make, whether it's your firm, Dan, my firm, a bank, a fintech firm, a large mature fintech provider, there's a lot of things in common. And a lot of the struggles right now in the industry are around sales and marketing processes. And what's interesting about sales and marketing is that, unlike, say, the core servicing systems or the back offices of a lot of these places, a lot of the tools that people are using for sales and marketing, and maybe even analytics in some cases, oftentimes horizontal in nature, meaning, you know, if you go to a consulting firm, you go see what fintech vendor uses, you go see what a medium to large size bank uses, they might be using some of the same tools. And they have some of the same struggles as things have gone more towards an e-commerce type of an environment. So those are a couple of the patterns that I see. It's a really interesting space. We do a lot of work in private equity and venture capital as well with the investors. In some cases, the banks are the investors, right? And the fintechs and the banks. And so it's just a really interesting mashup. I love it.
There's so many moving pieces. As you mentioned, it kind of reminds me of the media landscape. You know, wasn't that long ago in our careers that if you wanted to get in front of 80% of the audience in a market, your choice is the daily newspaper in a market and, you know, two or three TV stations and maybe some radio stations or the post office. And now there's this just fragmentation in media channels, although you could say that Google and Facebook have sort of replaced the newspaper for reaching a big chunk, but there's this huge fragmentation and the ecosystem and how everything works together. And so you're seeing the same thing in kind of the technology landscape of, you have the traditional big FISR providers in the banking space, and then the fintechs, and now then the horizontal technology companies.
It really is interesting. And I think the other aspect is, and not to overgeneralize, but hey, for sake of having some fun on the conversation today, if you just kind of park all the capabilities into running a financial service or a bank versus leading and growing, like if you just kind of separate those worlds, I mean, the running of the bank, the transaction processing, the money movement, it's pretty mature. It's pretty established. It works. I mean, there's certainly things that can be improved, but people, process, and technology generally works. What we're finding is pretty consistently is, when you look at the lead and grow category of sales, marketing, and particularly analytics. I mean, you know, data management and analytics is a really interesting area to me, because I think over the years we've seen that if we're talking about data analytics to run the bank in areas like, oh, I don't know, fraud reduction, you know, you have to be able to do that. Credit analysis, got to be able to do that, right? Those are things we almost take for granted. Analytics, they work pretty well, I think, in that world, in terms of just thinking about risk reduction, right? The things that your regulator would expect you to have, or even analytics that reduce cost. Banks have done an okay job of doing that. But the area where everybody seems to be struggling, I think, the most is in using data for revenue generation. And it's a consistent pattern. But I would say, if you look at over the last several years, the large banks have done a really good job of using digital and data to gain share. And now some of the challenger fintechs, I mean, if you look, for example, at the KBW indices, the regional bank indices, I think over the last, if you just look over the long term, not just over the last year, have been extraordinary, but over the long term of 5 years, which seems like a long time in this market, I think the regional bank KBW index is maybe up 40% over 5 years, 40% total, not per year, but total.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
If you look at the S&P, I think the S&P is up 100% or so. And if you look at the fintech index, what they look at of companies like Square, Intuit, PayPal, but also others in there like Fiserv and, you know, more mature, that index is up. I think it's like, you know, double. So it's double again, meaning the S&P. So clearly the challenger tech leaning forward organizations from a growth and value creation perspective over the last 5 years have made a huge impact. And it's creating some competitive dynamics in the banking. I'm not saying the banks are getting it all wrong. It's just in terms of there's a new order, right? There's a new order of competitiveness going on. I think we're all seeing.
So how is that playing out in data management? You mentioned you're seeing things in kind of revenue side. Are banks still building big, massive internal data warehouses to try to pull all that stuff together themselves?
In some cases they are, or they're pushing some of it out to the cloud where they can. But I think, you know, as I look at all the attempts at data, I would say that at least in the mid-sized market where we spend most of our time, at Cornerstone, the use of data, and particularly, as I said, if I just kind of narrow it down to three areas, risk reduction, cost reduction, and then revenue creation. In the first two categories, we don't find that bankers struggle too much with coming up with why they're doing something. If it's related to risk, normally they're either getting guidance directly from regulators or they just know they need to do it to save their bacon. If it's to reduce cost, there's normally somebody in the C-suite, CFO is normally very good accountable to driving that. The tricky part that we see in many banks isn't actually the data warehouse, although that's part of the issue, because that's really an infrastructure project of how to get data together. It's not about how to use data. The real struggle is, and it's one of the first red flags that we look for when we're assessing or looking at an organization is, can they articulate use cases for how they want to use data to drive revenue, very specifically? And then secondly, is there someone accountable? Because I think one of the interesting things, Dan, you've probably seen this as well as a veteran banker, is that, you know, cost management, obviously it's a bank-wide phenomenon, but the CFO clearly has leadership oversight for, you know, getting into people's business and figuring out how costs can be managed. There's usually a chief risk officer that has to be looking into risk. But if you look at revenue generation at a bank, it's decentralized. The various lending functions, the payments, if they have a payments leadership function, or maybe they have a retail or whatever. The point being, the issue is often cultural and organizational in that there's no accountability, therefore driving the use cases, therefore driving the data need, therefore pushing the warehouse or whatever the tools are to actually get the job done. I think that's the real struggle that we're seeing. It's a leadership struggle as much as a technology struggle. That's why I don't know how you see that, but that's just one guy's viewpoint. I mean, I don't know if you have a view on that, Dan, but that's kind of how we see it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think we all sort of see different parts of the struggle. And one of the things that I've just seen, and I've had some battle scars myself doing various data projects, you know, going back to the MCIF worlds. I mean, I think I can still remember when the department had an AS400 in the closet, which would probably, you know, give any junior InfoSec person today just hives thinking about that risk. We've just seen an evolution. But one of the things, the common things, and you talk about accountability, is data by definition is very hard to put one person 100% in the driver's seat for, because there are different stakeholders. You have the credit risk, operational costs, revenue. And so those are just a few of the layers. And then if you sort of peel the onion back, and so what I think is cool is you see much more, you know, I was part of a couple of projects where we tried to build the Uber data warehouse, and it was 2 years. And the problem was the world moved. So, you know, the specs were probably 100% right when we started, but 2 years later, when the thing rolls out, a lot of water has, you know, gone under the bridge, and there's new use cases, new systems, you know, in some case an acquisition, just new stuff that's happened. I think a lot of companies who have experienced that have gone to this idea that it needs to really be a continuous discipline. And you've got to solve for, okay, somebody's got to be looking out for data quality and stewardship and infrastructure part. And that you know, that's where a technology group is, you know, that's how they're wired. But then you've got to have some expertise in the business and ability to work, you know, somewhat independently, and tying into functional expertise, right? So, you know, like a household key is a great example. You know, that's probably owned by marketing. There's a bunch of different ways to do it, but as long as it comes back to the central data warehouse so that other people, so there's, you know, sort of one definition of householding for the company. You don't have, you know, risk householding and deposit householding and credit householding and, you know, wealth householding and so on and so. So, you know, so for example, and I just, you know, some of the perspective right now is we do a lot of work where somebody wants to understand their opportunities for revenue generation and haven't, you know, maybe they haven't done the hard work yet to put in that discipline, those functions and that kind of stuff, or maybe that's in process, but there's a lot of hard work that has to happen. And so we take our expertise and we can come in and very quickly take a very light data feed, bring it in, run it through a bunch of rules, compare it to hundreds of data points, and give them back very actionable information based on, they're sort of tapping into hundreds of points of reference and essentially billions of years of experience, you know, in a very turnkey way. And so I think you're going to see more and more of that kind of modular stuff happen.
Yeah, I like that. And I also like the idea of, instead of the big bang, the batch, right? The batch, yeah, of going off and then 2 years later, instead you have multiple projects in a portfolio, and you might be using turnkey providers to do two or three things. And yeah, maybe your long-term vision is you bring some of those things together into the same infrastructure. But I think one of the interesting things that I'm always looking for is just not simply just the tools, but what are the people doing? Yeah. And how are they using people? And by people, yeah, I don't just mean inside the bank, but outside the bank. So, for example, I was talking to a Capital One data scientist, and I asked her, I said, well, you know, tell me about your background. She said, well, you know, I was a statistician. I was looking for fraud, and I got really good at it. And then we realized I can use some of the same tools to find good stuff. It's not just about finding bad stuff, but it's about finding good stuff. And now they call me a data scientist because that's cool. You know, and status. Now all of a sudden, being a PhD in statistics is not cool, but being a data scientist. So we got a little bit of a branding thing on the people, but truly, it's how can we use some of the same people in somewhere where we're strong, like credit or fraud, and then use some of those experiences to apply it in areas where, quite candidly, we might just suck. You know, and then externally, how can we use some of the people outside the bank, whether it's, you know, God forbid they hire a consulting firm, right? Or third, any kind of third parties, whether it's, you know, analytics firms. And so there's all these people that are creating these. I love it that there's an entrepreneurial world where there's consultants and there's all kinds of startup companies that are trying to solve specific use cases. At the same time, within the bank, they have specific use cases, assuming they have specific use cases that they've developed. Then they can start arranging, okay, what can we tackle ourselves? What can we use outsiders for? And then where do we mash up the inside and the outside? But the key on this, I'm convinced, is leadership, accountability, and the use cases. If we don't see those two things, to your point, you just can't hand it over to somebody in IT and say, okay, Brad, it's all yours. I mean, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it's got to come back to, is the chief lending officer, do they even know this is going on? Like at most banks, the chief lending officer is the closest thing to, in our world, Dan, that we've come from over the years, in addition to banking, right? Been in the tech sector and been, you know, most industries have a chief revenue officer, somebody that has a big fat target on the back of their head. Yeah. If you don't hit the numbers, right, you're in trouble, right? Banks, they're a little wiggly on that. And so, but the CLO is the closest character I've found to the chief revenue officer of a bank. In some cases, if they're big enough, they have a chief banking officer. Okay, maybe there's some other variations on that. But where does the revenue accountability line up? What are the use cases? And does that person get behind those use cases? If those two things are there, I think a lot of the other things become a matter of, you know, iterations and learning what works and doesn't. But it's the other two pieces I think are absolutely critical. And in many cases, we still find that they're not in, it's not, this is not on the CLO's radar, and this is not, or the, whoever that chief revenue officer is, or it's, there's no accountability. And the way you can know that is, are there use cases and do they know about them? It's that simple.
Yep. So from what you see, what are some of those no-brainer use cases to use data to drive revenue?
Well, I think it's going to vary retail versus commercial, and then you kind of get into your. I think the slam dunks are going to vary by industry, and actually, I think that's one of the things that's going on now that really encourages me is in strategic planning processes. Banks are saying, "Hey, how do we get good at some specific market segments or target client bases?" Yeah. Then it's how do we get a leader that knows that, you know, if we're going to go after dentists, how do we get somebody that really knows the dental industry? Yeah, the data model and the slam dunks for revenue creation in commercial banking for dentists is going to be very different than what I cook up for overall retail. I don't really think you have to get into really sexy real-time triggers or anything like that. I think there's a lot of fertile ground in just looking for where are your current customers doing their business elsewhere and how are they doing it and what pains. I mean, I think what it really comes down to, I think it was Mark Randolph, the co-founder of Netflix, who said that the number one characteristic of an entrepreneur or an innovator is the ability to recognize pain. I think if you can focus, how can we go look for data that tells people, that tells us what pains they are going through. Now, we may not think that they're having a loan with us and paying for that loan payment with a payment, you know, a check or a transfer from another bank as being, but it's one additional relationship that they've, for whatever reason, decided to keep that requires a transfer every month or whatever the payment scheme is. That's a really basic one. And candidly, Dan, that one hasn't been around. I mean, that one's been around for decades, mm-hmm. but you'd be shocked at how many people just don't do the basics of going, oh yeah, well, we've dug into our bill pay or our card data or our whatever payments data. And we found that, you know, 70% of our loan clients are using these other institutions. And this is why we believe that they're using them. And in many cases, they may be perfectly happy with that. So maybe you don't have a big opportunity there. But there are others where, well, that's clearly a pain. We believe we can resolve that. And so whether it's by specific segments in commercial or specific demographic groups where you're creating product features for those people and then targeting those people, or if it's just knowing that they have maybe some superfluous relationships. It's one of the fintechs recently that their entire value proposition is people that need to consolidate 401ks. The average person walking around has got four or five of them sitting in all different places. All they try to do is just bring it together. Sounds like a very basic thing, right? Except you and I both know that if you want to go do that, that's going to be a pain. Well, that's yes. a good example. It's just a classic use case that was entrepreneurially lasered in on a pain. And but the underlying data to go start digging in and being curious about it is there.
You know, the other pain point, and I think you're spot on about the trigger. You know, there's a lot of time spent, and I can remember, you know, in a former life, we tried two different times to go, okay, we're gonna do some triggered communication when people make unusually large deposits or withdrawals. You know, this is talk about life trigger marketing.
Right.
And we believed in the premise so much, we wrote off the first learning as, oh, there's something must have been wrong in the technology we tried, right?
Right.
But when I think about the, you know, and you talked about pain points, when I think about the fundamental human psychology, okay, by the time somebody's gotten whatever is an unusually large deposit in their bank account, you know, maybe they sold a house or a business or a bonus, or maybe they just got a big birthday check from Aunt Millie, whatever that trigger is. By the time the money's hit their account and it's come up on, you know, the bank intelligence system, maybe the next day or maybe real time, right? Most people have already decided what they're going to do with the money because they know it's not like you or I, you know, get surprised one day and go, oh, look, I got my bonus check in my account.
Right.
You had some conversation with your boss, you know, some time before, and same thing with the unusually large withdrawals. By the time I've made a huge outflow, I'm making a purchase, or I've already decided where I'm going to take my relationship. We talk a lot about relationship banking. Well, okay, starting a relationship, your relationship doesn't start when you get married or you get divorced, right? Your relationship starts when you start dating.
Well, and, I think I totally agree with that. I think one of the things that people struggle with is there's a strategy part of the data side.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a tactical part of it. We have a tendency to go straight for the goods on tactics, which are great. Like, for example, you know, one tactic to your point is you need to be in the conversation and the place that they go for advice before you ever run across the data that says that Aunt Millie gave them the check, right? I mean, that's as a bank, if you don't have a mature, which is very likely you don't, a mature content marketing process that stays engaged with people in a self-buying world, meaning not content for the Kiwanis meeting, but content that they can self-absorb on any given Tuesday night, number one. So that's kind of tactical. Is you sort of have there, we always say, or I've said, there's two turntables and a microphone of delivery on this. You've got the delivery maturity on one axis, which is your data, your digital outreach, etc. And then you've got your content piece where you've got to have something interesting to say, but that's a tactical piece. I think the other big thing that we're seeing on a strategic side of things is that many banks have realized that strategically they have to change their portfolio and their makeup of their client base to allow that more of the data to naturally create value for themselves. So for example, you're a commercial bank that mainly has a bunch of CRE loans and hot consumer money funding it. Bad. It's just a bad model. You typically will want to be more of a C&I lending bank that's demanding the operating account. You're getting the cash management, so you're sitting on top of all the data, and you're more first in line to be helping them anyway. So part of it is tactical. How do you need to build up the maturity in delivery and content? Part of it is strategic, which is how does my bank need to change so that I don't have to work so hard to help someone? Right. If you're in the middle of their world all the time on both sides of the balance sheet, you've got a better shot.
Yeah. And I think one of the kind of fundamental points you made is thinking about it from the customer's point of view, right? Okay. How am I using data to solve a problem or pain point or help them up opportunity? And to do that well, you've got to be proactive. And, you know, the call out about content is awesome. I think there's, you know, we've certainly done some exciting things recently to help clients harvest intent data. So if you have a proactive strategy with a mixture of offers and content, harvesting that intent data can help the bank just be much more, oh, you know, okay, Sam is interested in estate planning. He actually clicked a link on to look at estate planning, you know, blog or white paper or podcast episode or something like that. Okay, I can now help to reach out. But I think also just, and we could talk all day on this stuff, but the key thing I think for the leaders that are crossing the chasm is in the revenue side of the game, it's not nearly as deterministic. You know, in operations, it's like, okay, how many items did you process today? Even using really advanced modeling or, you know, normative intelligence or any other techniques, you're still making a probabilistic prediction. In the revenue game, you're essentially making a guess. And to the example we were just talking about, the other person's got to make a choice. Rarely does somebody take every single suggestion you make. It's a competitive game. People have unique needs for all those things. And so I think it's fun, right? We talked about left brain, right brain earlier, but it is a difference in data-driven revenue management as opposed to data on the operational side or cost side. In that sense, it is very much closer to risk in that you're dealing with probabilities.
And I think the other thing is many banks are used to situations where there's 50 other banks that do it just like they do.
Yeah.
And I think data management's one of those using data to improve, in particular, improve revenue growth. There are some best practices. I mean, you know, you've got some of them, we've got some of them, they're out there. There are some best practices that you can deploy. But this is definitely one of those areas where I think you are more than likely going to be adapting some practices from other industries. You are going to be more than likely inventing some things. You should get very comfortable with being more of a builder as opposed to taking something off the shelf that, you know, has worked 50 other times. That's, you know, this, I'm not saying there's no slam dunks left, but this is an area where the playbook is really being written. It's not already done. It's not published and there's a canon. I think if you're someone who's an entrepreneurial growth focused bank executive or fintech executive, you're happy to play around in this uncertain, ambiguous world. If you're someone that likes rules and pre-existing playbooks, this is going to be a challenge.
Well said. So Sam, you've been at banks, you've been in on the consulting side for a while. If for some reason, and I'm not saying you're looking, but if for some reason you were to find yourself back at a bank or a credit union in that chief revenue officer job, what does your playbook look like for the first 100 days?
I think the first thing I'm looking at is I'm looking at talent.
Yeah.
Inside, you know, talent and culture inside the bank. I'm looking for what are true differentiators versus what is blah 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 claimed to be a differentiator. I'm going to spend some time on that because I really want to get a sense for where I do think I'm different. And the reason why I think that's important is because I think it helps you in terms of what we would call the resource redirect, which is you're constantly trying to get better. Like, for example, in technology spending, we're not finding that a typical bank of same asset size spends more money on technology now than they did. They just spend it differently. Mm-hmm. Right. And the same can be said for a lot of different things. And if you look at kind of the 3-point plan right now of competing well against fintechs and challengers, it's digital first delivery. It's basically marketing and it's call center. What I'm looking to do is what's making me different and how can I get more resource into digital delivery tech, data to help that, and marketing. And perhaps even, depending upon how mature the bank is, contact center, because call center has become huge as a bridge enabler for the digital landscape. So I'm looking at where the money's going. So talent and follow the money. It's like you go to watch an old detective show, you know, and they'll always tell you, you know, if you want to know where the bodies are buried, follow the money. And I think I think within a bank, it's not just about the money that's in the vault, it's the clients. It's the money that the bank is spending or investing or malinvesting, because they've oftentimes there are just a lot of things happening on autopilot. And the good news about going into a place like that fresh, especially someone for me who's been in and out of banks, but I haven't been a bank exec directly now for a couple of decades. You do get the fresh perspective of being able to look from the outside and say, where's the money going and why? And is it going to where we're different and we have a fighting chance of holding on to that difference, or is it just kind of happening?
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And the differentiation, you know, even 20 years ago, and there are the nascent stages of alternative delivery, online banking, e-services, you know, there was still a really heavy geographic component. I mean, you could be differentiated by being laser focused on a community. And I think there's still that. I mean, we work with some wonderful community banks, but I think the geographical differentiation gets really tough as you get bigger, because you just can't, you know, if you have 20 markets or 10 markets, you're kidding yourself if you're really thinking about I'm being local in every single one of those.
Ask your kids, ask your peers, you know, I mean, you know, right. my son's looking at his Robinhood app and he's not asking a lot of questions about, you know, who's hanging out at his high school. But I would say I would be looking for, if you are truly geographic, and that is the play, I would start looking for, okay, what affinities do we have going on here? Do we have anything? Are we partnered with the high school or not? No? Okay, well, who says we're the local? I mean, and if not, I'll come back to, okay, well, there are different kinds of communities. And when we get into community examinations, now you're talking about what's the difference? I mean, a community is just a group of people that have something in common, right? So, which is the same as a industry niche or a target market niche. So I'll come back to who are the people? It's not going to be everybody, right? But who are the people that are most in our DNA that we're good at helping? And then what can we do do that? And then, you know, obviously that has to be sustainable. But I just generally think that on autopilot, there's not enough going into pain resolution in delivery systems, especially self-service delivery systems. And on autopilot, marketing is being, and I say marketing with a lowercase m, not marketing department, but marketing activities, growth activities, sale, you know, digital sale, whatever you want to call that bucket. And again, the accountability and the use cases, I think, will help drive that more than any department head.
Yeah, the sort of true full go-to-market. When you think about the classical marketing definition of the, you know, the four C's or the five P's, how are you going to market to, given your differentiation point? And I think there is some exciting things that the marketing department, the CMO, can do as part of that playbook or that go-to-market effort. All right. So, Sam, you talked about kind of the merging of personal and professional. If you could go back and sit down with a young Sam right out of college, what's your advice to him?
Well, two things. One of them I alluded to earlier, which was don't try to keep your personal life and your work life so separate. Bring it more together and focus on the joy of all of it together. That would be one thing I would say. I think the other thing is I'd probably tell him not to work as hard. All those years in airports and all that. And I'll tell you what, this pandemic, it not only made so many of us truly grateful for many things that maybe we had taken for granted, but just being able to be with my wife and we can, you know, be with our sons and walk our dogs and just the basics that I think so many people take for granted. As someone who worked for tech firms for years where I was traveling a lot, a road dog and then a road dog as a consultant, I'm not against traveling and I'm back to traveling some now, but let's put it this way. I'd much rather do 40 or 50 days a year on the road and truly focus on where I need to be in person instead of 120. And just kind of going back is to say, how can you work smarter and focus on the things that matter as opposed to try to prove. I came from a long story short on this is that let's just say I landed in industry with a chip on my shoulder that said I had to work like a dog and I had to have a work ethic and had to prove my value. And, you know, I think maybe I overdid it a little bit. And I'd say, hey, just chill. Let some things take their course and try not to work so hard. I don't know about you, Dan, but that was my story.
I think it's well said. You know, certainly I've seen people make the mistake of being too lazy, not working hard enough, but you can certainly work too hard. If you become a workaholic and you lose sight of the other important relationships in your life, and so I think that's great advice. And it is exciting to your point about there's a lot of ways to collaborate. I mean, you know, we're working on this podcast miles apart and it's fun to do it and fun to have the conversation and see you. But it's, you know, we didn't need to travel for this. And so that's a great example.
No, but I'll tell you, if you're going to be at, one of the conferences, I'm actually going to be back out on the road at a couple conferences here in September and I'm looking forward to it. But I know it's been a joy talking with you today and I don't really feel like we've lost much in this thing, you know, with video, and in fact, in some of my, well, many of my client engagements, I could make an argument about where it's actually improved some situations where people, they're more engaged for whatever reason. Maybe it's techniques we're using. I don't want to take credit for it, but I would say, I think Zoom has made it really easy, but other technologies have as well. And but it's been fun. And this has been a great chat.
Awesome. Yeah, I've enjoyed it also. That's it for today on Top Quartile. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Top Quartile wherever you find podcasts on any podcast app. And while you're at it, we'd really appreciate a 5-star rating. And if you're interested in getting an opportunity assessment, head over to infusionmarketinggroup.com to learn more. Thanks for listening.